stress and post-traumatic stress come up for discussion a lot in society. Right here on this program, you've heard stories of people who sought medical attention for what they thought were physical maladies, only to find that their bodies were only showing the effects of psychological trauma from years before. Think of today's discussion as that effect a generation removed. Mark Wolin is the author of It Didn't Start With You: How Inherited Family Trauma Shapes Who We Are and How to End the Cycle. Mark Wolin studied English and psychology in college. He's the founder of the Family Constellation Institute in Northern California, and he has taught his approach at universities, hospitals, and clinics. Mark has had articles published in some journals and has also had his poetry published in The New Yorker. Mark Wolin, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange today.
Thanks for having me, Jeff. I'm happy to be here.
Is this the career you planned for yourself, or did things take a few turns along the way?
Oh, things took a few turns that I didn't expect. I thought I would end up in academia with English, and, you know, I've always had a fascination with words. In fact, my own words would be crucial in my healing, but what happened threw me for a curve. About 26 years ago, I lost the vision in one of my eyes, and I was told to expect to lose the vision in the other eye as well. I had a condition without a cure where the retina scarred and leaked, and frightened and figuring that I would lose my sight altogether, there were some words that I remember were very potent for me, and this terror, I'll lose everything. I won't be able to take care of myself. I'll fall apart. I'll be ruined. And years later, I would learn that those very words led me somewhere, back to my family, where all my grandparents were orphans. They'd all lost a mom when they were babies. In fact, three of them lost their mothers as infants, and one lost her dad when she was one, and basically her mom's attention is. Her mother was grieving. But as I was losing my eyesight, I went on a search for healing. And that search led me halfway around the globe, as far as Indonesia, to learn from some very wise teachers, very profound principles, one of which was to heal my relationship with my parents. But remember how if I had this break from my mother, like everyone in my family. In fact, because each of my grandparents had lost a mom, what passed forward in my family was a feeling of being broken from a mother's love. And so I was told to go home and heal my relationship with my parents, and I resisted the idea, and I heard it a couple times and ended up going back to the States and healing my relationship. And in doing so, my vision returned, which was strange. I never had linked the two. All the doctors could tell me is that stress had somaticized into a physical way and was probably the result of me losing my vision, though it couldn't be cured. And in healing, my vision returned, and for years I just began teaching some of these principles, some of these concepts that I've learned.
You know, at its essence, what makes it really interesting story is that you went as far as Indonesia, as you said, to look for wisdom, for healing, for solace of some kind, and essentially somebody you've turned to for guidance says, call your mother, in essence.
As strange as that was, I looked at this guy. I'd been doing a lot of meditation at that time, and I'd learned to be comfortable with what was uncomfortable inside me, and I thought he was going to christen me Meditator of the Year. I waited in line all day to see this great teacher, and he looked right at me. I should say he looked right through me, and he could see what I couldn't see and told me to go home and make peace with my parents. I heard it twice, which I did, and again, how was I going to do that? This idea, this feeling, this experience of being broken for generations, all of us broken from our mother's love, and that feeling of anxiety. In fact, I remember being a little boy, 5 years old, when my mom would leave the house. I'd run into her bedroom, and I'd open up her drawers, and I'd breathe into her scarves and nightgowns, thinking that I'd never see her again. She would leave the house, but the feeling in my family is all those grandparents that never did see their mothers who died mostly suddenly. And so I was crying into her clothing, thinking all I had left was her scent, and that would be the end of it. And I remember 40 years later sharing this with my mom. It was very poignant. And I said, Mom, when I was a small boy, I would go into your room and cry into your clothes when you left the house. And she looked at me and said, you did that too?
Oh, she did it with her own mother, huh?
With her own mother. And what was funny is after I wrote the book, my sister just read the book and called me and said, you did that too? And it was a family pattern, that feeling that we'd never see our mother again. That's what had passed forward.
Now, the idea of family trauma being passed down is not new. You're not the first person to talk about it. Whose footsteps do you follow here, Mark?
Well, it's known. It's scientists have long suspected something like this was happening. In fact, there's this neuroscientist, I think she's a rock star, out of New York, Mount Sinai Medical, named Rachel Yehuda. And she has done some very fascinating studies that the data's just come in about 10 years ago, where she discovered that Holocaust survivors and their parents and their children share the same trauma symptoms, specifically the low levels of cortisol, which is the stress hormone that brings us back to normal when we've experienced a traumatic event. And so she also finds the same pattern in the babies who were born to pregnant mothers who were at or near the World Trade Center when it was attacked during 9/11. Again, the babies share these compromised levels of cortisol with the mothers who had gone on to develop PTSD. The children had PTSD. In fact, just last year, she found that Holocaust survivors and children share the same gene changes in the exact same region of the same gene.
All right, much more to talk about both on the physiological side and the psychological side as well in talking about inherited family trauma. Mark Wolin's book is called It Didn't Start With You. We'll come back and talk more with Mark and take phone calls and emails from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Mark Wolin. He's the founder of the Family Constellation Institute in Northern California. He's written a book called It Didn't Start With You, How Inherited Family Trauma Shapes Who We Are and How to End the Cycle, the thesis being that stuff that happens to your parents or your grandparents can be visited upon your generation and your children, for that matter, as well. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So when we talk about stress on the human being, we talked to Bessel van der Kolk, who you mentioned in the book, about the body keeps score about 2 years ago. His point being that if stuff has happened to you in your life and you're just kind of shoved it aside, it's going to visit itself upon your body later on. But he deals with people who had trauma in their own lives. This is a bit different, though. We're talking about next generation and sometimes more than one generation.
Yes. When we experience trauma, it changes us. Literally, it causes a chemical change in our DNA. And this can affect the way our genes function, sometimes for generations. So when we go to have kids, our kids aren't always born with a clean hard drive the way we'd like them to be. There's an operating system in place, one that contains the fallout from our traumas, perhaps our parents' traumas, even our grandparents' traumas. So our children can be born with fears and feelings that don't belong to them, which is why I wrote the book, so we can make these links and we can break this cycle.
That implies almost a cellular memory, doesn't it?
Exactly. The idea of epigenetics in the first place is that there's a way in which trauma gets stored and then transmitted to the next generation to protect. The idea, the genius, really, of the body is to protect us from the same traumas that our grandparents or our parents experienced. So if our parents or grandparents were born in a war zone, they might learn a skill set of very quick reaction times, or they learn to duck when there's a bomb or a loud noise or gunfire going off. And that might make them very reactive, sensitive. Their body would be on hyper alert. In fact, they'd be the right person to be with if something like that happened because of the quick reaction times. So this skill set then passes forward ultimately to protect the species. Well, the problem is when we're born in a safe environment, but our body is reacting as though trauma or stress is happening around us, it can have detrimental effects.
You mentioned the chemical change, which brings us back to Rachel Yehuda and her discussions of epigenetics, which I think you're helping me understand more completely than I ever have before. It's not changing the gene, but it's affecting changes in which the ways in which the gene works.
Exactly. So the gene sequence stays the same, the DNA sequence, but the way the genes will express, they'll turn up, they'll turn down, they'll turn on, they'll turn off. This is what changes. And basically, it's to prepare the species to deal with the effects of something that's uncomfortable or something that can affect survival. They've done some amazing studies with mice. Do we have time that I can talk
sure,
to?
Sure, yeah.
Okay. So out of Emory Medical in Atlanta, there's a team of researchers that found that the trauma experience can pass for three generations physiologically, again, through these chemical changes. It's as though the traumatic memory can pass forward. They took male mice and they shocked the male mice every time the mice would smell the cherry blossom type scent. And they'd introduce that scent in the cage and zip would go a shock. Then they examined the mice and they found, well, the mice is preparing to protect itself. Now there's enlarged areas in the brain that can detect this smell of the cherry blossom scent at lesser concentrations, the large area for these receptors. They also find changes in the blood and in the sperm. And then they take that sperm and inject it into a female mouse who's not shocked. She has offspring, pups. Then all they do in the next two generations is they introduce the smell of the cherry blossom scent without the shock. But the pups and the grandpups become jittery and jumpy. In other words, they have the trauma response, but they've never experienced the trauma directly. It was as though the grandparents' and the parents' trauma was experienced by the children and the grandchildren.
Mark Wolin, again, is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is It Didn't Start With You. Is it necessarily genetic, though? I mean, obviously, if they've done these experiments, there's lots of evidence here. But how much of it could also be environmental? I mean, if you grew up in a family where people don't talk about some horrible things that happened in generations past, I wonder if that sets up a sense of foreboding or we need to keep the silence or any one of a number of different ways that would be expressed in the ways that the children and the grandchildren move about their lives.
What I found is what we don't talk about can have the greatest effect on us.
Mm-hmm.
So there's always that question, nature versus nurture. And it's a brilliant question. Epigenetics is just one piece of the puzzle, one ingredient of the soup. However, what I found is that people who don't know about these traumas can be affected with the trauma reaction, the trauma feeling, the trauma fear, without even knowing what happened. And then they go home and they find out that the symptoms... Can I give a story?
Sure.
I once worked with this woman. She was consumed with anxiety once she went to have a baby, once she became pregnant. No anxiety prior. Very great life. But now that she's going to have a child, she's consumed that she'll do something to hurt her child. So I asked her some of the questions that I outline in the book. Did anybody in your family, well, prior to that, she told me that her worst fear is that she would do something and harm her new baby. So the obvious question, did anybody in your family harm a baby? She said, no. And I said, let me ask you again, did anybody in your family ever harm a new baby? And she said, oh my God, my grandmother, when she was a young woman, she lit a candle, she started a house fire, she lit the curtains on fire, it caught the house on fire, and she couldn't get her newborn, who was upstairs, out of the house. and the newborn died. And the woman said, but we were never allowed to talk about it. In fact, the woman didn't even have it in her conscious recall until she was probed. It's like that. And in that moment, she made the link that she was carrying her grandmother's experience, her grandmother's feeling of harm my baby, and never even thought to consider it. But once she made the link, she could take the steps to break the cycle, which I outline in the book.
So earlier you mentioned that cortisol levels are low in the next generation. That's the stress hormone. You don't want to have too much cortisol. Is it just that they're below the point where they can feel like they can protect themselves or something?
Well, the cortisol level, when it's low, that will cause cortisol spikes. So our cortisol system won't be regulated, and we'll have a difficulty down-regulating when we get anxious. What we find are this Rachel Yehuda, who we talked about before, she says that you and I are three times more likely to have PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, if one of our parents had PTSD, and as a result, we're likely to struggle with anxiety or depression.
Are those the usual manifestations of trauma being visited upon next generations, anxiety and depression?
It can be many things. It can be anxiety, depression, obsessive thoughts, just anxious feelings, fears. My interest is looking at what I call core language, and this is what I teach people to do in the book, is to come up with their own trauma language. So the book helps you be a detective and asks you questions to uncover the language that you use when you're anxious. For example, that woman who I spoke about a minute ago, who was terrified she'd harm her new baby, that was her trauma language. My trauma language, going back to my story when I was losing my sight, was I won't be able to take care of myself. I'll fall apart, which was the story of all the orphans in my family. We each have some what I call core language that's connected to maybe stuff that happened to us in childhood, absolutely. But sometimes it's connected to things that happened to our parents and grandparents, and we've merely biologically inherited these traumas.
All right, I want to come back to core language in just a little bit. I want to remind our audience we're talking to Mark Wolin here on the Jefferson Exchange, the founder of the Family Constellation Institute in San Francisco. He's written a book called It Didn't Start With You, How Inherited Family Trauma Shapes Who We Are and How to End the Cycle. There are psychological and genetic components to this, he says. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We have an email here from Emmy in Ashland. She says, I can't imagine anything more life-altering or traumatizing than being captured and enslaved or living that way from birth until death. In what ways do you think African-American descendants of the North American slave trade still feel the effects of this generational trauma? And beyond systemic oppression, how are their opportunities diminished or lives altered by the biological effects their bodies may have taken on? That from Emmy in Ashland.
What I've seen is that any people who've experienced great trauma or oppression, like the Holocaust, like slavery, like massacres, like genocides, Armenia, Cambodians, will experience or will see remnants of these traumas in the generations that follow. In fact, many of the scientific studies on epigenetics are based on groups of people who've suffered due to their race, their religion, or nationality. There's great studies now beginning to happen with the Cambodian children showing that the depression that continues. Rwandans are experiencing the nightmares, even though they were born after the Rwandan genocide, the massacres. Kids from the Holocaust, as I was saying before, the Holocaust survivors and their children share the same gene changes in the exact same region of the same gene. This is science. This was published in Biological Psychiatry. It is, in a sense, we can break the enslavement. We see the effects in Native Americans, African Americans. The methods and the tools I talk about in the book are helpful in healing these wounds.
Here's another call from Wolfgang in Sunny Valley. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Mark Wolin.
Good morning. All of this stuff applies 100% to me. Now, a couple of things. I remember once biking through a little village, and it was Saturday, and they were playing marching music, and I totally, totally freaked. And, of course, the background is that I'm the offspring of Holocaust survivors. And another part of the same picture is when I met my wife, she said, you suffer adrenal exhaustion. And that also makes sense. And we've been trying to figure out how to relate it back to the experience that I had directly, indirectly, makes no difference, of the Nazi time and what it did to my ancestors and what kind of truly, I mean, this stuff is real to me.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you for this call, Wolfgang. That's exactly right. Whether Wolfgang knew this in his family or he were adopted and never knew this but heard the marching music, it's possible that the body response could be the same. We don't have to even know about the traumas to be affected. And the point, one of the points I make in the book is it's very important to know about them when we can. It's important to, I always say, shake that family tree and see what falls out. Ask questions. What stories didn't get told? What traumas didn't heal all the way? What secrets that people tried to keep? See, we have this fantasy that if we can immunize the next generation, if we keep our lips sealed or the lips of the past, the story of the past sealed, but it's not true. In fact, what we don't talk about can have the greatest effect. Thank you for this call.
Thank you for that, Wolfgang. Mike in Medford, in a similar vein, writes, as long as I've known, my mother and her parents were very high anxiety and negative thinking people. After getting deeper into genealogy, it turns out that my paternal side of the family all fled Russian pogroms in the 1890s. Along with cousins in the Holocaust, nobody has ever passed down the stories of what happened. It seems the less a family knows, the worse the scenario, so writes Mike in Medford.
Mike, you sound like you could have written this book with me. That's exactly right. I always tell people, tell your kids, do we have time for a story?
Sure.
I one time worked with this mother who was concerned her little boy, a 7-year-old boy, started pulling, and it's one of the stories in the book. He started pulling out the hair at the top of his head. So he had a bald spot where the crown was, a 7-year-old boy from a condition called trichotillomania, the pulling out of hair. Mm-hmm. And I said to the mother, I was interested in this age 7. I said, tell me, at 7, what traumas happened in the family? And she said, that would be me. When I was 7, I told my mom, hey, Mom, I'm hungry. Could you go down into the kitchen and make me something to eat? And her mother had an aneurysm and died in the kitchen. And the woman felt guilty and never even spoke about her mother. To do so made her feel great guilt because she felt she killed her mother by telling her mother to cook the food, which isn't what happened. But the age 7 became a hot spot, almost like an ancestral alarm clock. So here's her son pulling out his hair, mirroring to his mother what she felt at his age in the anxiety and stress that she had long ago shut down. So I said to her, the mother, I said, do you tell your boy about your mother? She says, no, I don't talk about my mother. And I said, go home, draw pictures about her, tell him how much you loved her. In fact, put her picture over his bed at night and tell your son that he blesses his that she blesses his head. And actually, I had her find a picture because all I could think of in that moment that would be visual for the boy, because it's important to get as many sensory experiences as possible, is find a picture of a halo and tell your son that grandma is like this halo, this energy that's blessing his head at night. So now when the boy would go to pull his hair, he would be met by a pleasant feeling of his grandmom who loved him, loved his mom, and blessed him at night. And he stopped pulling his hair.
Huh. Mark, it may be outside the scope of the book, but are there any studies that looked, for example, at adopted children away from the birth families where there's no environmental discussion or lack of discussion about previous generational trauma?
One of the reasons I wrote this book is to get some of these studies. into gear. I wrote it, first of all, for people who struggle with mysteries, unexplained anxieties, unexplained depression or depression we can't get to the bottom of, obsessive thoughts. But I also wrote it to generate awareness in the medical and the therapeutic community. So not only are there tools that people can use to heal, but we can get studies like this done. I'd love to know those answers. I wish I could give you a definitive answer. My guess, like I told Wolfgang, is that I suspect from what I've seen and many of the adopted people I've worked with, that the trauma, in fact, do we have time for a story?
Not really. We're close to a break here.
Okay.
But we'll get it on the other side of a break, so that gives me a chance to introduce that. So we're talking to Mark Wolin here on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is called It Didn't Start With You, How Inherited Family Trauma Shapes Who We Are and How to End the Cycle. We'll come back and talk more with Mark and take more phone calls and emails from you with your own stories, observations, or questions for Mark. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Mark Wolin, the founder of the Family Constellation Institute in San Francisco, writing about the human mind and trauma and how trauma can be visited from generation to generation. Even things that happen to our parents or grandparents, he writes, can lead to bad feelings in our own lives through genetic and environmental components. His book is called It Didn't Start With You, How Inherited Family Trauma Shapes Who We Are and How to End the Cycle. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. We're just starting to talk about the potential effects outside of the realm of knowledge where perhaps somebody's been adopted. You said not many studies about that, but you're about to tell a story?
I one time worked with a woman who was a cutter. And she'd been cutting since she was 14. In fact, the first time she cut at 14 years old, she carved the words in her thigh, fat pig. She never knew she was adopted. They told her, in fact, she thought her biological mother, she thought her adopted mother was her biological mother. At 21, she's told that she's adopted. She searches out her biological mother and finds her mother was raped at 14 by a guy who, how she was conceived. I remember asking this woman as I looked for that trauma language, I said to her, tell me about the word fat pig. What does a fat pig mean to you? She said, a fat pig is someone who takes what isn't his. She had no idea that she was the product of the rape. She had no idea that her mother was raped at 14. Because she thought her mother was always the adoptive mother. And once she made that connection, she understood those words that she carved into her thigh, fat pig, much more clearly, where her birth father would have lay on her birth mother.
Wow. Let's take a call from Sandy in Mount Shasta. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Mark Wolin.
Yeah, hi, Mark.
Hi, Sandy.
I've already ordered your book, but I haven't had a chance to read it. Yeah, I think you're doing some pretty amazing work. I have a question for you, but first I just want to affirm what you're doing. Some years ago, I decided that what seems to be holding us back as a species is our accumulated trauma history that we steadfastly have refused to process and heal from because of the kind of beliefs you cited of, you know, some sort of magical thinking that, well, if we just don't talk about it, it'll go away. And now we know that that doesn't happen. So keep up that great work. You're one of my heroes. And
then
my question is, if you've made any linkage with or heard of something called ACEs study, the Adverse Childhood Experience study that's kind of gaining traction in the medical community.
I have, and I'm a fan of the work. I've seen Nadine's TED Talk, and it's quite compelling.
Was there a further question there, Sandy?
Yeah. The problem with, the average childhood experiences test, as far as I'm concerned, is a great start. But, of course, it doesn't address the kinds of things you're talking about that are epigenetic.
Well, let's extend that lens just a bit and look at what would make a parent harm a child. What would make a parent be distant or critical or aggressive? Sometimes if we can get, the enough distance to look back and look behind, it gives us it's like finding that missing piece of the puzzle that any child, any boy, any girl in that birth order in that family would have received something that wasn't personal in a sense, but was engineered by trauma. For example, what makes a father leave a family or a mother drink or a mother not take care of her children or give away children? Sometimes when we can look at the traumas that were experienced to that mother or that father or to their mothers, their fathers, or in the generation prior, it starts to make sense. One of the things you'll learn when you read the book, Sandy, is you'll do a genogram of the trauma in your family history, and you'll be able to see where these feelings come from. In fact, also where the childhood experiences, what creates a parent who can hurt a child? It's important that we now take in this larger view of the traumas in the family. Often behind our broken feelings, I can speak to my own, from a child to a parent or a parent to a child, are just traumas. Something traumatic happened that blocked the flow of love, that made that parent not be able to love, that broke that parent from the child or that child from the parent.
If you'd like to follow up, let our listeners know, you can check out what Sandy was talking about. Nadine Burke Harris is the person who gave the TED Talk about ACEs, the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study. So Nadine Burke Harris is who you'd be looking for if you Google it. A couple of emails here about trauma here. Jesse in Williams writes, how can a person resolve a family's trauma when there's no memory or information about it?
Yeah, great question, because it lives in your language. So one of the things that you'll look for when you read the book is what ways, when you're anxious, when you're depressed, when you're in a aroused state, what's that language you say? Well, what language do you use to describe your fears, your worries, your relationships? That's the language that I call core language. You see, when we have a trauma, clues are left behind. Clues in the form of emotionally charged words and sentences. And they're like breadcrumbs. And when we know how to follow them, when we know how to uncover these unconscious words, we speak them, but we don't link them. But when we know how to link them to the traumas in our family and the traumas in our childhood, it's like finding that missing piece of the puzzle that lets the whole picture come into view and gives us a context for understanding why we feel the way we feel, even when we don't know what happened. We know something happened. In fact, it's interesting to know when nobody's talking in a family, that's where you look. Mm-hmm. You look past the silence.
So this brings up a question that Becca asks, writing in from rural Lane County. She says, I wonder how long this effect lasts. I mean, weren't all groups traumatized at some time in history?
I'm so glad she asked that question. Thank you, Becca. Going back to that mouse study, they show that the effects of trauma can last for maybe 3 generations. Going back to that enlarged area of the brain and the changes in the blood and the sperm, yes, 3 generations were affected, but that grandpup, that little mouse that also was affected, his brain was not enlarged. He did not have the changes in his blood and in his sperm, which led Brian Diaz, the researcher out of Emory, to make the statement, maybe 3 generations maybe not longer.
Three
great question.
Okay, thanks for that. Let's move on to talking about treatment. And you say that healing from trauma is akin to creating a poem, and I'm sure this is where we get into the core language section a little further. Explain that analogy, though, if you would.
Okay. So I'll talk in two ways about healing. First of all, to heal, we often need to have an experience that's large enough, powerful enough to override our old trauma feelings, our old habit of feeling bad. And then we need to have this, not only do we need to have this experience, but we need to practice the new feelings of this experience. So this is the way we create new neural pathways, neuroplasticity. We focus on and practice a new experience which can override or overpower the old feelings. They show that experiences like meditation or visualization can even lead to not just creating new neural pathways, but changing the way our synapses react, the way they structure together, that Hebb's law of neuroplasticity, what fires together, wires together. And then we can create new neural pathways, have enhanced gene expression. Now, you asked an interesting question, how healing is like a poem. Well, I believe, my background, of course, is writing poetry and hearing language. And when we find that right image that moves us, that we trust, that right story, that right image, it's what can change us. It's also the new feeling that we begin to practice. So that image could be, it could even go back to realizing behind my mom, that made my mom distant, the hypothetical story, was the fact that she was given away. So of course she was distant. And the feeling, the image could be, it was never personal. She would have given me more if she could have. If she had received more, she could have given more. And when we lose that idea that it's personal, just that image alone is enough to change us. So there's other parts of that that are like a poem. The right image, the right timing, and the right language. So I look at sentences that also help us heal, and images that help us heal. And the right timing, for if we arrive at that image too early, we can't take it in. If we say the sentence too early, we won't hear it. If the sentence isn't precise, we won't heal it. In the book, I teach people to find those healing images, to find their healing sentences, and then to practice the feelings that arise from those new images, those new... You know, there's interesting science right now that if we visualize an action or a conversation, it activates the same regions of the brain as though we're actually living it. So some of the exercises in the book might have you visualize having a conversation with that grandfather who died in the Holocaust. Or it might visualize hearing something from your mom that you never heard. Or it might have you visualize doing something physical, visceral, something you can feel in your body, involving maybe your breath, maybe you're bringing a hand to where that feeling is. Maybe even contacting that part of you that has never been able to calm down. When we can bring awareness, breath, and sensation all to converge together, we can shift the inner sensation. We can change our brain. We can build new neural pathways. They now say we can even affect the way our genes express.
About 2 minutes left. I want to take this call from Sue in Mendocino. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Mark Wolin.
Hi, I got a quick question. I've had some nice results with EMDR with an experienced psychotherapist over time, and I was wondering what your feelings were on that in terms of a more focused healing, and I'm going to hang up now.
All right, thanks. You appreciate that. So EMDR, which is the eye movement therapy.
Yes, yes, absolutely brilliant work. Yeah.
All right, so do you support that idea?
I do, yes.
Okay. So coming back to words and core language then, so is there any core language that is universal, or is it completely what works for the individual?
We each have our own trauma language, our own core language, our own anxious language, our own depression language, our own when we get into those rut language. That's the language we're trying to unearth. That's also the seed inside that language is also where the healing language comes from.
So
in the book, that's what I teach people to, how to be a detective, to unearth that language, to make the link to what happened in your family, and then to devise your own healing practice from that trauma language, from that image, from what happened, so you can heal, so you can leave it in the past where it belongs, so you don't have to relive what happened to your parents or your grandparents. You can change your brain. You can heal.
The idea that trauma leaves us speechless, is that you're finding or someone else's? But it's a fascinating one, that you have to put words to what happened to you.
It's amazing. Bessel van der Kolk talks about the speechless terror of trauma, that when we've experienced trauma, we lose our ability to speak about what happened. Actually, the language centers of the brain are affected. But what I found is that language is not lost. It's in our unconscious, and it arises and rears its head when we're anxious, depressed, or feeling remnants of trauma. That's the language we're looking for.
It's a really fascinating book. It's called It Didn't Start With You, How Inherited Family Trauma Shapes Who We Are and How to End the Cycle. Mark Wolden wrote it and joined us today in the exchange. Mark, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Jeff. It was lovely to talk with you.
All right, take care.